Eric Jacobus, how are you, mate?
Good, Scott. How are you?
When it comes to screen fighting or the art of action, I always think of you, Eric, because you have been doing it for a long time now on the indie scene originally. But man, have you put together over the years some crazy fight sequences. I've always watched your stuff, always admired it greatly. And for a show like this, I can't believe it's took us so long to get you on. So thanks for doing it. You are going to teach us about the art of action.
Man, I'm excited to. Thank you. And this is one of my favorite podcasts, Scott. So it's a huge honor. Thank you.
Yes. Put that in your pipe and smoke it. All right, cool. I'll cut that out.
Don't cut it out. It's great.
So, Eric, just tell us concisely, if you can, how you got into the business of screen fighting. What lit your fire? How old were you when you did martial arts? All that sort of thing.
Yeah, I achieved the yellow belt in strip mall kempo karate, like all good 12-year-olds, and ducked out of that. I had no interest in martial arts for years. And I got into math. I was a math and physics major. I was going to get through, you know, Calc 2 in high school, and left high school a year early and was going to go. I wanted to work at a particle accelerator, honestly. Like, that was my vision.
Yeah.
I was a computer programmer when I was 15. Yeah, I was a big tech nerd. And so I was learning programming and I learned how to build websites. But then I saw a Jackie Chan movie with my dad, Drunken Master 2. And this was, you know, after a couple of his films had come out in the US in the late 90s. And and I got hooked. And I decided to review Hong Kong movies after that because I knew how to make websites. And back in 1998, that was no small endeavor. It took a lot of effort to put a website up back then.
Yeah.
But I knew how to do it and I could make it kind of, you know, I could design it fairly well because that was my job. And I wrote probably 500 Hong Kong film reviews. I really obsessed over it.
Oh, wow. On this website.
And I would just focus on the action. I'd give a little brief moment, you know, I'd give a brief note on the story and then I'll just break down every fight scene and start naming stunt guys. I'll go back and edit old reviews and add stunt men's names in and went through 500 of these things. And at a certain point, you know, I had a forum. Vlad Rimberg was on this forum. Manny Manzanares was on this forum. And we would just talk about Hong Kong films. And then we started thinking, well, what if we just started doing these backyard kind of skate videos, but doing it the Hong Kong movie style? Because we had broken down these fights so much, we could kind of understand how they made these things. And it was very efficient. You know, unlike the Hollywood system, where it just requires so much upfront costs. And we started sharing sound effects and filmmaking techniques, and that's how it started back in 2001.
So you immediately recognized the way they shot the Hong Kong stuff as opposed to the American standard, get all the coverage, figure it out in the editing room. I mean, you do that anyway as a kid, because I used to make my own home movies, and I would never think, oh, I'll do a master, and I'll do this, and I'll move it for that. We just get the pieces of the puzzle, right, and put it together as we did the fight. Was that your experience, just getting out there and doing it?
Yeah, it was like you said, it's like making a home video. You don't even think of coverage. So it's almost like de facto indie filmmaking is the Hong Kong style in a certain way. But there was also this way that, you know, in the Shanghai studios back in the 30s sort of figured out how to make wuxia films very compelling, because they would use editing in very novel ways to simulate flying, to be able to defy physics. And there was also that novel aspect of it where you could tell an action story with editing and camera. So it wasn't just the camera that was showing the action. It was also the edit that figured into the choreography. And I think, you know, the people that really perfected that were guys like Sammo Hung, Corey Yoon, and they were great filmmakers on top of being great choreographers. And when you were able to think about action in terms of the edit, it's like you have another dimension of the action design. And that was really compelling.
What would you say is most important if you had to choose? Being able to edit in your head as you shoot, or a knowledge of how to move the camera to best accentuate the action?
I mean, I think in the hierarchy of things, it's going to come camera first, but your edit can ruin the camera really quickly. But I think if you don't have it on camera, then you can't save it with editing, right? Technically. So, I mean, it's just a simple, fact of life that if it's not on camera, it doesn't exist.
Yeah, I probably chose the two most important things and got it to tell me which one was best. I think so. Anyway, I don't know. That's why we're here talking to Eric. But what about formal martial arts training? Did the films come before that? Did the martial arts training come from a love of Hong Kong cinema, or vice versa?
The first thing I realized that I could do, because I did some gymnastics and springboard diving. I was a little bit acrobatic, and I could hit the concrete pretty hard because I lifted weights a lot. I lifted weights since I was 13, and I wasn't big, but I was strong, and I could hit the ground without pain. And I didn't know you were supposed to wear pads.
Yeah.
I was not aware of that, Scott. Nobody told me that.
So you enjoyed throwing yourself around as a kid?
Well, yeah. And there was a technique to it in these Hong Kong films. And there was a technique to making it look very visceral when you hit the ground. And, you know, in Western films, they would do it too. They did these great falls in Westerns also. And I grew up on vaudeville films too. And there are some amazing falls in, you know, the Keaton and Lloyd and Chaplin films. And even the Stooges did some amazing falls. So
that's the inspiration for Jackie Chan, isn't it? So
absolutely.
Yeah.
Theater, right?
Yeah. Physical comedy, physical theater.
Yeah, and the ability to hit the deck, to be able to exhibit what people think is pain, get some sympathy points there. I was good at that. I could do comedy. I could sort of deliver against expectation. Yeah. I'm really good at looking like an idiot. In fact, when people look at me in Rope-A-Dope, for example, they think, oh, this guy is a dope, right? He's just a complete idiot. And then I can kind of deliver against that, right? That's what Chaplin did. It's what everybody, all comedians do.
Yeah.
And then after that, I started taking martial arts after the filmmaking. Primarily.
But you're naturally just an athletic kid that loved throwing himself about, and so you just it fitted. You got into it.
That's right. That's my buddy Chelsea. We met at a video store talking Hong Kong movies, and we were actually looking for the Hong Kong movies that the other person had in his hand. And so we decided, you know, let's do some of these Hong Kong style fight scenes ourselves. And so we went out late one night with our buddy Ben. We had a camcorder and shot this thing in an hour, I think. And this was after watching, what did we see? I think it was Jet Li's, one of Jet Li's Wuxia movies. And we went out and did this. And first time we made a movie, you know, after this little
stunt. You've only gone and done the police story, but it wasn't onto the moving escalator. Yep.
And after this, I mean, we went nuts. We realized that, oh man, there's like a new thing that we can do with ourselves, so that we're not just, because we're in a small town. This is Redding, California. We had nothing going on, really. Yeah. And so we just needed something. And that's what we did. And we started doing that every weekend for a year and a half.
So that is the stunt people, is just a group of lads that found a common thing that they enjoyed and got together and started kicking shit out of each other and filming it.
Right.
And it just so happened that there was enough of you in the same town that enjoyed it.
Yeah, I think we got them all. Yeah. About eight of us.
And so, yeah, there's no better way of teaching yourself. I mean, anyone listening out there that's got aspirations to do it, there's nothing better than just grabbing a camera and going out there and teaching yourself. You can see from that it's humble beginnings, and we could pick that apart till the cows come home. But
of course,
that's how you get started, right? Just get stuck into it.
And what we would do, I mean, every time we went and shot something, I'd stick it on. So we would shoot. I'd get the team together on Friday and kind of plan the shoot. We might shoot Friday night. We'd shoot Saturday. I'd go home Saturday night and edit. And then Sunday, I'd finish editing and upload it by the evening. And then on Monday, we would start getting feedback. And I would put it on our server and put it on the forum. And our forum was pretty big at that point. Like I said, you know, we got all these indie filmmakers around the world doing this stuff. And we would
get 98, is it?
This is 2001.
And you're filming that on what, a Hi8 camcorder or something? Or?
Not even that. It was VHS-C. It was literally a small VHS.
So you editing between two VHS players?
No, I never had to do that. This was right at that moment where digital editing was starting to come around, where you could buy like Belkin USB, video capture device. And it wouldn't capture all the frames, but we didn't care. I mean, I did what I could with my computer that I built. And because I had edited clips for the Hong Kong film reviews, I understood editing and how to put the clips together. And so I had the software to do it already. And then I ripped off some sound effects from Hong Kong movies and stuck them in, and that was it.
Man, they've got it easy these days, haven't they?
Yeah.
Back then, when I first started doing my home movies, I had to edit between the two VHS tapes. Like I would do it in the camera, and then I would edit it into onto the VHS. And now I had to go VHS to VHS. And I knew that when I press record on the one, it would wind back 5 frames. And then when I press play on the other, that would wind back 25 frames. So I had to just time it all
up. Oh, wow. And be like, yeah, that's crazy. Yeah. We didn't have to do that. You said that we laid the foundation. I mean, a lot of that was just us ripping on each other on the forum, and we were brutal to each other because we really wanted to get good at what we were doing. Well, indie filmmaking derailed my math and physics plans, and I just found a new passion and applied to film school, got in at San Francisco State, and moved out there summer of 2002. And started making a new crew there. First thing I did when I got there was I opened up the phone book, went to martial art classes. I just went down the list. And the second one I came to was a Taekwondo school. And went in, learned Taekwondo from a Chinese guy named Andy. And I started telling him, what I'm doing in San Francisco. I said, I'm trying to make indie films, Hong Kong style indie films. And he says, wow, I've always wanted to make like Donnie Yen style action films. He's a big Donnie Yen fan. And so we sort of had an exchange there, right? Where he would teach me Taekwondo and, we'd do movies together, and I taught him Falls and all that. And so he was sort of my first guy in the Bay Area.
Okay.
And so I put him in this short film. I had a production class. It was 16mm. And the film teacher, she said, make a shot list. I made a shot list of 45 shots, which was very easy for me to accomplish in the 3 hours that we had. And she said, cut it down to 20. You'll never make it in time. I said, you don't know what you're talking about. I've made movies for a while now. We did it, and we went and shot this thing in 16 mil. I think we did 60 shots in 2 hours.
Guy's teaching you Taekwondo.
That's right. Yeah.
Andy.
Yeah.
Right. So what did your teacher think about you making a martial arts movie?
In film school, you're taught, action movies are base and pointless. You should make art. You should make socially conscious, whatever it might be. And I just wanted to make action films. That was the entire purpose for my being there, which I was kind of a scourge for these classes. Not that there's anything wrong with doing those other things, but it's like, this is what I want to do. And so I showed the film, and I went through quite a process to make that film very presentable. I had it color corrected at Monaco. I mean, it's 16mm color adjusted at a lab, and I had edited the whole thing on a I think it was called a Steenbecker or Steinbecker. It was a 6-reel editing thing that I had to break into a room in order to edit it at the school because there weren't enough editing stations. Long story short, I show it, and it's one of the only films that's actually complete and exposed in the class properly. And she looks at me and she goes, she shrugs, and that was it. That was her response.
I knew it was going to be something like that.
Yeah. So I think I did it right.
Now I'm going to teach a lesson, and it's called editing. Check this out.
Yeah.
So, but there you go. There you go. It's like, yeah, that's what they say about my movies too. Go figure.
We probably spent 5 days shooting this fight, I think. And it was cut short because we just wrecked ourselves hard on this fight. There's one coming up here, right here, this one. So I hit my head on the ground right there.
So the dust so hard.
Yeah, it was nasty. So I had a concussion, called it a day, came back, we started shooting this. There's Ed in the garbage can. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to see that again.
Right here.
I can see that now.
I didn't even know what I was planning to do with that stunt, but there it was. I think I was trying to go onto the garbage can, and there was just no way I was going to make it. Everyone else thought, oh, well, yeah, Eric should just go onto the garbage can, and didn't even come close.
I like the handwork there. The blocking.
Yeah, it's my inspiration was Sammo. I always loved Sammo's handwork. I thought he would do it the best. He did almost everything the best, but
so are you watching Sammo's stuff and just going, right, yeah, how's he do that? That looks great. I'm gonna copy that.
Yeah, and the thing about Sammo is that he kind of knew how to make the shapes look good for the camera.
Yeah.
He can make that stuff look so nice. It was like, it was geometric almost. And so we really wanted to kind of copy that aesthetic and the timing and the pacing of it.
Now, this was released as a whole movie, or I'm mistaken?
It's a 35-minute movie. And this is when our crew was getting a lot bigger in the Bay Area. And I met Steve Reedy, who was on a DVD that we were on as well. Got introduced to him. He's a great filmmaker. And so he shot this and kind of brought like a new element of filmmaking to our action. Vlad Renberg's in this. You'll see him right there in the middle.
Yeah.
And he's got some great moments in this fight too. So we shot this in Dublin, California. It was so hot that day. It must have been, I bet it was 115 that day. It was so hot that I was wearing these tabby boots and the bottoms were melting on the concrete. And they were so thin. And so I had to put bubble wrap between my feet and the tabby boots.
I like that bit of connection there. Any padding on your foot, or you just because you got the tabi on?
No, I didn't put any padding. We had just seen Ong Bak. Ong Bak had come out like maybe a year before this, and so we really wanted to do the real contact stuff.
Yeah. Give it up to the gods of action. I always appreciate a bit of throwing up in a movie after a gut punch kick. There you go. That's Vlad, isn't it?
That's Vlad, yeah.
Yeah. That works pretty well, doesn't it?
Yeah. It was a fake leg. We had a roll of, it was like a cardboard tube we stuck in Vlad's pant leg.
So do you normally edit this stuff?
I think Reedy and I edited this one together. I edited the fights in this movie for the most part. And yeah, usually I'm editing though, to make sure we get our bests. You know, I'll pick the selects and I'll lay sound in a lot of the time too, because sound design is so important in fight scenes. The voices, the hit sounds, the timing of the hit sounds, and also I change the tones on the fight sound effects too. Like I'll increase the pitch on one and lower it on the next one, so it plays a little bit like a song. So if there's a combo, it's not pop 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 pop, it's like pop 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 pop. Right. So I just change the tones on it, and it just adds that kind of extra level to the fight.
I mean, that's the thing, when you start off and you've just got your camera and you can get the angles and you put the camera wherever you want and you get the angles and you can get through it very quickly in a day. And then when you go and you do a professional film and you've got a cinematographer and, you know, you've got the sound guy and you've got the actors to deal with and you've got all these people that want to have their time to do their thing. You know, what you used to be able to film a big long fight scene in one day, and then professionally you just can't do that because everything takes longer. And that is something that can be kind of frustrating. But of course, you've got to get used to it because the cinematography is as important as the acting, as the directing, as anything else. But sometimes when I was first starting out, it was hard to see that. I was like, no, just got to get the action, man. The action's what they want. Death Grip is lit much better now. How did you accomplish that?
I just kind of gave control of the look over to the DP. My one request was I just have to be able to see the action and then otherwise have fun. And but this is a fight with Alvin, where we wanted to do just a series of very long takes of complicated knife fighting. I don't remember what we were watching at the time, but Alvin is one of those freaks of nature who's a great actor and just a physical performer like no other. And I think this fight took us 2 days to shoot because it was so hard to do these long takes, and we were trying to do it so that it wasn't blocky. We didn't want the action to be blocky. We wanted it to be nonstop. Like there was an intention the whole time for both performers. Like they're just trying to go through each other. That was the whole idea. And that just took a long time. But like you mentioned, you know, Drew was the DP, and every shot he was very careful about each shot. You know, he would adjust the lights on all the shots, you know, for the close-ups.
Yeah.
He would move the lighting around. And I was like you, I would.
But it helps when the lighting is from above because you don't necessarily see it, and you can move the camera 360 a lot of the time, can't you?
Yeah, we had studied Twin Dragons, the end fight in Twin Dragons in the car factory and the car shop, and that fight is lit from above and it's very general lighting and it's a beautifully lit scene, and so we were looking at that when we designed the lighting for this movie, and just tried to make it as general as possible, but that's still, each shot kind of has its own touch.
Yeah, we would do that for the Undisputed films. Just most of the light's coming from above. It helps make your muscles look bigger as well. So, you know,
true, yeah, top lighting, it makes you, and yeah, it looks nice.
But yeah, if you haven't got a lot of time and you've got to shoot a fight and you haven't had the pleasure of previs, which if you can do the previs, then do it. But even then, you know, you don't know where the light's going to be. You want to be able to shoot 360. You don't want to be constrained. So if you can get light from above, that's preferable.
Yeah. And like you mentioned, I mean, it's so important to actually have a look to your film so that it's not just a home video camera shot under street lights. I mean, that can get the action design concept across, but it's like to really touch people, the lighting is its own kind of character. And I know nothing about lighting. I'll never figure it out. In fact, I've set up a light for this podcast, and I don't know if it's going to work. Like, I don't even know if I'm visible right now. But when other people get it, you look at it and you go, yeah, that's its own character. That's part of the choreography almost.
Yeah.
You know, like it has to be. It's a camera's part of the choreography, editing, lighting, the sound. It's all part of the fight design. And if you can play to the lighting, I mean, how much better is that?
This is essentially where the classical American way of shooting cinema, that's why it is what it is, right? Because we're lighting this side. So we're going to get the master and then we'll get the coverage from here and here. And then we're going to flip to the other side and we're going to light the other way. And then we'll get the coverage that way. So that's the reason, right? But coming from, I mean, I started in Hong Kong cinema and that's how I learned. And they have the luxury of time there. So they'll say, right, we're going to do this shot now. And they set up the lighting for that shot and then they do it. And then, right, that's the edit point. We're moving on to the next bit. And they set all the lights up accordingly. But if you don't have a time, which on my movies, for the most part, we don't, you have to find a way to, put the lights in a place where we can still move fast. And sometimes at the expense of the lighting, you know, it's a balancing act. We want to get more action. So we're okay to let lighting fail a little bit here. And sometimes you've got to have a DP that's willing to let that slide, but we've got to let it slide sometimes as well and give him what he wants. So it is a balancing act.
It's true. I did a film in India called Man Who Feels No Pain. And that was the situation we were in where we had a DP who was incredibly good. And we were doing an outdoor location and we had this, I think it was like a 40 by 40 foot screen up. And he would light there's a ton of lighting on one side and I would want to flip to the other side, but I couldn't do it because I would say like, okay, let's flip to the other side. And the thing about India is that, if you want to flip to the other side and you're the action director, you tell the DP looks at you and he says, okay. And he does this. And then an army of 100 people starts moving everything. And then 2 hours later, now we're on the other side and I'm sitting there going, okay, action. And we get our shot. And I was like, okay, now I need to go back to the other side again. Yeah. And he looks at me and he goes, okay.
Yeah. Okay. But it's going to take 2 hours.
They never fought me ever.
Yeah. Because they have time over there. But that's cool, so man.
Much infinite time. Yeah, it's crazy.
But it's one of those things, isn't it? Because when you grow up making your own videos, and you start creating and you're filming these fights and everything, that's what you don't think about when it comes to professional filmmaking.
Correct. That's correct. And I would say too, when shooting previs, you have to consider that. So I did a previs for Altered Carbon, the first episode in the hotel. Yeah. I did the hotel fight previs and I shot it the way I would shoot it. And not realizing that I should have shot it as if they're going to shoot it with coverage, as if they're going to do it with a single lighting setup. And I didn't. And so I don't know if my previs was very useful for that fight because I didn't shoot it in a way that was actually useful for the production team. And they couldn't replicate it, really. Like, there's no way, like, time-wise, there's no way they could have pulled it off. And the fight was much shorter and it was cut up differently. And so that's one thing to consider when doing previs is shoot it as if you're on a big Hollywood shoot.
Yeah.
And then choreograph it for that because you might actually come up with something great now. If you can choreograph it with those limitations, then you can come up with something great still.
There you go. Yeah. You got to think about everyone's job and what everyone wants to achieve. And it's no good telling the cinematographer to go and do one because he wants it to look good.
Yeah, he'll never do it your way. I mean, it's rare.
You won't be working with him again when he becomes the next Roger Deakins.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Because the director's going to listen to the DP. That's always the marriage on set, right? Because that's the marriage that has to last. And if the action director, stunt coordinator comes up and starts talking to the DP, I want all these different shots, DPs, a lot of the time it's just going to say, no, get off of my case. I'm doing it the way I need to do it because it needs to look a certain way.
When I was working with Chad Stahelski on John Wick 4, he understood the power of the cinematography and very much gave enough time for that to be achieved. And it's very noticeable when you watch any of the John Wick movies, you know, the look of them. They just look incredible. So it's all worth it. But you've got to have the time as well. And sometimes you don't.
In the game, he's kind of like the most human of the characters, perhaps, because all of his weapons are just sort of these police weapons.
Still want to make fun of my fucking vest?
He's got grenades and batons and all that. And it kind of, I don't know, it kind of fits my character. I'm kind of like the everyday man. We shot this over underneath the Hollywood sign up in the hills.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, I went for a walk up there once. Pretty treacherous.
Yeah.
And who's this guy that you're fighting against here?
It's Brian T. Brian T was playing Liu Kang. And every now and then there'd be a double in there, and that would be Kim Do. And then Casper Van Dien is Johnny Cage. And Mark Dacascos is in the show. Originally, Mark and I were going to do a two-on-one against Liu Kang. And we had choreographed this whole thing at Jam in LA. And I was so disappointed. We just didn't have time to do the whole thing. And so they just used my bit of fighting. They decided to keep my piece of fighting at the beginning, but originally it was going to be a two-on-one. What could have been, right? So, but had some great conversations with Mark. First time I ever met Mark Dacascos. Just a fantastic
great guy. Yeah, lovely guy. Now tell me about the Kickshinery.
There was this video back, I don't know, in 2010 or so. It was all of these judo throws, and it was just this repeated series of judo throws, like this quick montage, and every one of them had a name underneath. Yeah. And I thought, man, that's so cool. It was this like viral video that went around. And I thought, somebody must have done this with kicks, and nobody had done it with kicks. And I thought, well, let's get all the kicks in one video together and try and find like a naming convention that was standard, you know, or there were some that had never been really named. And so I just named them after the person who did it.
Is that really called the unblockable kick?
Yeah, that's from childhood, right? Is where you punch and kick at the same time.
Armada. What's an armada?
I believe it's an outside crescent, like the capoeira style outside crescent spinning.
Okay. Yeah, it's just amazing that you've done this. And how long did it take? Was it something that you genuinely did years and years?
I mean, just look at my hair. It just goes from, you know, short to long to short again. It was probably about a year and a half or so. Just at random sessions, I would just go in and I would just work on two kicks sometimes. You know, some of them were really hard.
Yeah, sometimes you wake up in the middle of the night and go, whoa, there's another version of the axe kick. Go, right. Go!
It's exactly that. I'd rush out to the gym and start filming it. Yeah. Brilliant. Also, you know, there is one film that did this. It was Huang Zhangli's Art of High Impact Kicking. It's on YouTube. It's an hour and 15 minutes, and it's just this tutorial of every basic kick. It's the eight kicks and all variations. And so I kind of took that stuff and just expanded upon it with everything I could find.
So what happens if you know a kick, but you don't know what the name is? And it's, how do you find the name?
I would ask people. I would try and like, I would just dig. I'd dig as much as I could. There was some tricking convention. That's my wife. There was some, there's some convention also with trick kicks. Like try to slide in pocket knife. That's one that's a trick, tricker terminology.
So of all the people on the planet, you may be one of the only people to have performed every kick ever invented. I mean, how many people have done? I know that I haven't. I may have done some of them by accident, but Jesus, yeah.
Well, it's kind of easy when you're doing it against a pad. You know,
the
pad doesn't play back.
Me, I only do them if it's outside the pub on a Saturday night and somebody's coming at me with a pint glass. Okay, yeah, talk to me about Beardoff because this needs explaining.
All right, so I think we were about to do rope-a-dope and I had to shave. And I said, well, if I'm going to shave, I'm going to make a video about it. And so in this film, I bearded me meets this sort of like Terminator version of me. And the Terminator version of me seems to want something. And it's like, well, what does this guy want? And he starts attacking me. And it's this horrific, horrific kind of, it's like a snuff film where he's ripping this guy's beard off, right? And he starts putting it on
the enjoyment of putting it on there. Look, he's loving it.
And like, this is all practical. So we had figured out on a shot list of how to like make this stuff all work. And Sean Finney was doubling the other me for every shot. And and then it just goes on repeat.
But the continuity of it is mind-boggling, because you'll have to shave a bit off and then get both sides of it with that part off. And
exactly. So like the first thing I did was I think I shaved the right sideburn first, and then I shaved, and then so that was getting the, you know, this side ripped off. And then it was getting this put on. And so we figured it out. We were really careful before I, you know, even touched my face with the razor, and then it worked. I mean, if we had done it wrong, it would have been a waste, and I would have, it would have been a wasted shave.
Well, this is the thing. What makes you're so inventive with the things that you do. You're thinking outside the box, which is very original.
Thanks. I mean, that's sort of the nature of comedy, where you look at standards and conventions in the action genre. This is what I do. A lot of time I spend is watching action films and going, well, how can I do something different than that, deliver against expectation, but do something that's also logical and also kind of interesting? And that's just the creative process.
Very inventive.
So I started copying Tekken moves. I had been in China for 3 months with Clayton. He brought me on to do Heart of a Champion. And I was pre-vising out there, and I wasn't really physical when I was in China, and my health really declined because I was in Beijing and I got so sick, and I came home and I was just 30 pounds lighter, Scott. It was bad. And I was like, well, I got to get back to health. And so once I kind of came to, I started just working on my performance, and I thought, well, why don't I just copy Tekken characters as like a test to see if I could do that? And Tekken's this fighting game from the late 90s. I think a lot of nerds learned martial arts from Tekken, actually. It was the first time a lot of us had seen capoeira. You know, it was, there was a Jackie Chan character, like Liu Long character.
I like the Taekwondo guy.
Yeah. And the funny thing about that Taekwondo guy is that when I showed this video to the director there, Katsuhiro Harada, and he said that Taekwondo character was hand animated. They didn't even motion capture him. So I was trying to replicate moves that had been done by hand and not by a person. A lot of the game had been motion captured, but apparently that character had not. I didn't know that.
How did the idea come about for Rope-a-Dope? Because I mean, obviously it's Groundhog Day, but for me, seeing that as a martial arts actor, I must admit, it was very jealous. It's one of those things where you go, oh, of course. Why didn't I think of that? It's one of those. It's like when you watch The Raid and you go, hang on a minute.
Yeah.
Martial arts mixed with Die Hard. Why didn't I think of that?
After I did Death Grip, Clayton Barber, director, and he's done some amazing action scenes for Creed. And he called me up and he said, well, I see what you're trying to do. Let's try and do, let's one up your action and go to the next level. And he had a script that was like a Die Hard. It was a Groundhog Day. I can't remember who wrote this script, but it was a Groundhog Day mixed with kind of an action thriller. And it was a little too serious. And I thought, like, well, we should stick to comedy. I mean, Death Grip is a very serious film. And I didn't want to go back to that kind of serious part of my life again. I really wanted to stick to comedy. And so we started throwing ideas around. Well, what if we kind of mix the Groundhog Day concept with a martial art movie? And every time there's a knockout, it's a reset. Yeah, we had that moment too, Scott, where we thought, like, why hasn't anybody done this? This is crazy. I wrote that script in about a week, and then 2 weeks later we were shooting. Like, we wasted no time because we were afraid somebody would figure it out at the same time.
Yeah, it's just a great idea, man. And if anyone hasn't seen it, I urge them to stop playing this now and go and watch it and the sequel, because it's brilliantly made. How long did you have to make it?
We shot the first one in 4 days, and it was the same DP and cameraman from Death Grip. So it still had that look, and right. He still gave it that great touch. And it was, you know, it's very traditional the way that we shot it. A lot of just, you know, locked off kind of, it kind of plays like a vaudeville movie because it's a silent film. Technically, there's no dialogue in it. Yeah. So we wanted to kind of play it like that too. Not too crazy of editing, not too crazy of camera work, just show everything. Right. Because the concept is in the story, it's in the acting. And so when we did Rope It Up 2, we actually shot the entire end fight in one day at one point. And it's a long fight. It's actually much more technical than the first one. And then Dennis and I have a final fight in the wrestling ring at the end. We actually did that fight that day too, but it was only about a minute long. And Clayton, who produced that one as well, he said, we got to go back and do that fight again. We went back a month later, and you can tell my hair totally changes between, you know, when I'm out of the ring and when I'm in the ring. And we made that fight, you know, what it is now. And it was a great call. And that was a full day. Dennis pulled his hamstring on the first move. It was a tough day, but you wouldn't know it watching the fight.
Yeah. God, that sucks when you're injured and you got to just go get through it.
But he's a physical marvel, Dennis. Dennis Rule.
I worked with him on close range briefly. Nice guy.
And also a great filmmaker. He understands all that stuff, and he thinks in terms of editing and camera work too. And that just gives you a different kind of angle with action design and movement.
Now, when you're doing Rope-A-Dope and you're filming like all the bits that happen and again and again and again and again and again. So have you just storyboarded it? And obviously you've been very careful to know of how it is supposed to be and how it changes for each thing. Yeah. It must be a lot of homework.
It was, yeah. And the mistake that I made on the first one was writing different clothing for the different days. Like, he wakes up, it was like seven loops. And so, and there's four wardrobe changes. And so I had to bring the wardrobe with me everywhere we went, and I'd have to do four different wardrobe versions. And that was the hard part.
I wear a black t-shirt every day, so you could have just done that.
Is that your closet? You open up the closet, it's just black t-shirts.
Yeah, taekwondo this is the standard bottom. Scott Adkins kit.
Yeah. I wear a gray t-shirt every day. I'm like the rainy day version of you.
You should come to England then. We've seen Zatoichi, and I was a big fan of Rutger Hauer's Blind Fury growing up. And again, it was like when you guys came out with Blindsided, again, I was like, oh, flipping hell. What a great idea to do that. To do like a modern, you know, American spin on that, which essentially was done with Blind Fury. But for you to do that, I thought, man, that was a brilliant, inspired thing to do. So again, it was just like a eureka moment, was it?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, it was something that Clayton and I were talking about for a while. He really wanted to do a Blind Swordsman movie. And he came up with the motif of the apple pie and Walter being, you know, making an apple pie and being a cook. And it was just a very kind of quaint, you know, like all American kind of hero. Right. And when I started watching Zatoichi and I watched all those films, some of the greatest films ever made, you know, I was watching other blind films and I thought, well, I really want to make sure I do the blind, you know, the blind motif justice. And actually play off of that somehow and utilize that in the storytelling and kind of like the way that a blind person doesn't really follow the same social conventions that other people follow. And that makes them an outsider. It also makes them a scapegoat sometimes. I really wanted to play with all that and also the performance too. And so to study being a blind guy, I knew a blind guy who was a skier and a downhill mountain biker.
Well, how did he do that?
I think with mountain biking, he has, he holds somebody, but then for skiing, I think he just does it, man. I don't know. Like, he can't see. He's 50. He was at the time anyway. He's in incredible shape. The way he works out too, because I trained with him. And he would work. He showed me how he worked out. He doesn't know how much weight he has. He just sort of like pulls weight until it's too much for him. You know, it's just totally different kind of thinking.
Yeah.
Walk. Anytime I'm not fighting, I close my eyes behind the sunglasses. It was just easier to act that way.
Yeah.
So for example, I mean, one of the things that you know, when someone can see, when, like, if you have a cup, for example, and if somebody goes to reach for the cup, if their hand starts opening as it approaches the cup, that's not how blind people touch cups. They touch it with the back of their hand and then they grab it. It's all very sensorial and little things like that.
That's the attention to detail that you don't necessarily pick up on as a viewer, but when you see it, it rings true.
Yeah. And people know it when they see it. Yeah. And so we just try to do that. Anytime I'm walking down the street, I would try and remember where I'm at and use a blind cane accordingly. And so I trained with this blind guy, and when I put a blindfold on and walked around San Francisco with this guy, and did a whole behind the scenes about it, and scared the hell out of me. Almost got hit by a car. And you just think about the world so differently. And it was 8 hours without, it's like I had to pay with a credit card at one point. And I was like, how do I sign for the tip? Like, what do I do?
Yeah.
He says, you got to figure it out. I cheated. I had to cheat to do that. I got to cheat. And I knocked over a glass of water on the counter when we were ordering food. Oh, it's embarrassing.
Yeah.
But that taught me something, that, you know, this is not just something to mock, to just try out and to dabble in. Like, this is somebody's life who lives like this. And that's a different kind of person, different kind of personality, different kind of action, different kind of movement. Totally different.
Can you show Walter the way out, please?
Wait, he's just a
blind guy. The film was originally only 12 minutes, and this was part of that original short. We had pre-vised this at a gym in LA. Khalid, Brett, and Nick, and Roger over there. And these are some of the best. Like, these guys are great. The thing, too, the thing that really sells fights like this is the other guys. Like, if you're not acting as the other guys, I mean, they're so good as performers. They just look like actors fighting, right? Which is what you want.
Yeah.
And I didn't have them do martial arts. Like, these are street thugs. I'm not going to have them kick. I'm going to have them pull out knives. It has to make sense for the fight, right? We had to limit ourselves. Walter has a cane, the main character. He's got a cane. He should use the cane. That should be the main weapon. I wanted to kick, and I send over videos to Clayton. There's one kick. I do a couple.
Yeah.
You know, Clayton said, like, let's just do less kicks. You've got a sword, man. You've got a cane. You got to use that thing. And then we, everyone always laughs at this part. So all the guys start pulling out knives. Okay. And I got this little, like, letter opener inside of my cane. One thing that you notice if you ever simulate being blind for a day is your hearing changes within hours. You start hearing differently. You really do. I could hear walls. There was this moment when we were on the rooftop and I was with, you know, the guy who was training me. His name was also Walter, by the way. And he, you know, I had the blindfold on and I was freaking out a little bit because I knew there was a swimming pool there and I didn't want to fall into it. He said, now listen, do you hear the fountain? I was like, I can't hear a fountain. He's like, no, just listen. And you can actually focus your hearing. And I focused my hearing and I said, oh, wait, I can hear it. He said, yeah, let's walk toward that. It changes so quickly. It's amazing.
Yeah. So you spent the day on this action sequence and the drama?
The drama and the action took 2 days.
Like that little tricky bit there. I mean, that's probably not easy to do, is it? Spinning that around your hand.
I'm actually a very clumsy guy. I'm really bad at catching a ball. I'm not like Jackie Chan. It takes me so many takes to get that.
Well, Jackie Chan would say the same thing anyway. So, you know, can't fool me.
Yeah.
Is David know?
Yeah, and he's a producer on it too. And David's another one of those guys who, like, thinks as a filmmaker and performs like a filmmaker. So he knows how to play the camera. He understands the editing process. And so we were really able to solve a lot of problems together.
It's been watched a hell of a lot of times on YouTube. Millions of people have seen that. So it's very successful. People love it, right?
Seems like it, yeah.
Yeah. So I'm going to ask you a plain question. You've always been kind of in the indie arena, doing stunt people and, like, that's on YouTube, rope-a-dope's on YouTube. What's the deal, man?
Like, I just call it stubbornness, maybe. Maybe I'm just too damn stubborn, Scott. I mean, ask anybody. I'm pretty stubborn about things. Like, I'm collaborative, but I'm stubborn about design. I'm stubborn about making sure that we're not doing the same thing everybody else is doing. And that sort of weeds me out of the pack very quickly. And I'm not going to be a victim about that. I'm going to go off and I'm just going to do things the way I need to do them. And I don't mind that. And I've done pretty well for myself by doing that. It took me a long time to become a full-time stuntman. Like I said, it took me 12 years of doing day jobs and depleting my savings, just doing this, just grunting it with indie films until I was noticed by Santa Monica Studio to do God of War. And when they brought me in to do motion capture for Kratos, it was like, I can do this. Yeah, this is the new trailer, father-son trailer. We motion captured this one. That's me.
So what sort of stuff goes into this? I mean, obviously we all know how it's sort of done in the volume and all that now, but in terms of like, how does it work? And is there a director that's got a vision of what the trailer's going to be and it comes to you guys to come up with the action? How does it work?
Yeah, I mean, the director's got storyboards, and then he came to us to design the action. We did a video previs, we did a motion capture previs at our studio, and then we went and motion captured the full thing on an optical volume in LA. So it's a long process to do motion capture, especially when it's polished like that. And doing the gameplay as well, because, you know, when you're doing the entire game as well, because I did for the most part, I did Kratos's stunt combat in God of War and a few other characters too. And that's a very different process than filmmaking. It's fundamentally different because you are in a white room with a bunch of cameras around you and you're wearing this spandex suit with little balls on it. It looks pretty goofy.
Yeah.
And you're supposed to pretend to be, a 6'4", you know, angry dad, right? Which is like bearded dad, which is not far from the mark as where I was at the time, actually. I'm just a little bit shorter than that. I could act it pretty well. But I was just doing the stunt combat. The nice thing about motion capture is that you can have a bunch of people playing that character. After doing God of War, my brother-in-law, Zach, and I got together, bought a couple motion capture suits. They're Xcend suits, so they're much lower cost, but the quality is extremely good. And we decided to start selling motion capture to game studios. And we did this for God of War Ragnarok, the latest one. But in order for us to actually get our name out there, you can't talk about a video game while you're working on it. It's like government secrecy. So I said, well, let's just make some short films using the motion capture suits. And I figured out how to use a 3D engine called Unity. That's what I shot this one in. And it works like Premiere. It's almost the same exact thing. If you know After Effects, you could learn Unity or Unreal, and you could shoot and edit a 3D action film. Dennis and I motion captured this entire short. It was 8 minutes long. We motion captured the entire thing in 2 days with the two of us.
Just the two of you playing each part.
In a crew of two people. And then the editing process, that takes a while. I was learning the engine at the time, but you could probably do the entire layout and editing process in a month and a half.
Look at this guy.
So it's a little rough around the edges. The hands aren't quite right. There's certain things. Yeah, we wanted to remake the Big Trouble in Little China alley fight.
That's what it is. Six demon bag, man.
Right. What's in an egg?
I don't know, but make you feel like you can do anything. My film company is called Six Demon Films, so I'm obviously a big fan of Big Trouble.
I love that. That's cool. Same deal. Yeah, we motion captured this whole thing probably in 4 hours, and then a 3D designer laid it out in another 3D engine called Unreal, and that's what they shoot. I think Disney uses Unreal to do all their productions now, all the big ones anyway.
Star Wars stuff is Unreal Engine, isn't it? Within the volume, whatever that's called, with the big
LED wall.
Yeah.
And then you lay it out. It's like an After Effects composition. You lay it out, you lay all the clips out, and then you go in and you can shoot it with a virtual camera you actually hold up an iPad, connect the iPad to the Unreal Engine, and then you're actually a camera in the scene, and you can shoot like that too. So it's a fantastic process. Nice thing too is
so that once you've got all the footage, all the moves, all the choreographies in the computer, then you just decide what angles you want to choose.
Yeah, and as we're shooting it, I have the angles in mind already, so we can still be economical. But the nice thing is that if your shot is off, you don't have to redo the performance. Performance is done. You just reshoot it with the iPad. So you just play back the performance, and you can just walk around the performers in 3D and shoot it however you want. I think shooting previs that way, once this is easier for stunt viz guys to use, that'll be the tool.
All right, yeah, that'll be it. And I suppose if you like do a kick and it's meant to hit the guy's face, but for the angle that you want to use, it doesn't work, you can always just move them closer together.
Yep.
Yeah.
What's nice too is anytime we do impacts, like if I'm going to kick a guy, I don't actually have to kick him. I kick a pad, and then another set technician will bump the guy with like a kicking shield, and then I'll just put them together. So you get a really good impact, but there's no injury.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Cool, man. Brilliant stuff. Learning all sides of the filmmaking trade.
I would approach action design like people approach skate videos, where just assume you're going to do all of it and concept the action so that it works through all the stages of production. And this is the way that indie films should just be made. It's not as easy in Hollywood because you're not going to have control over the camera, and you're definitely not going to have control over the edit. But when doing your own projects, to be able to just do it and lay it out in your head in an abstract way and plan out your action so that it's good for camera and it's good for editing. Study the masters like Sammo Hung. They did it perfectly. He sort of like invented the entire technique, you know, like he perfected it anyway. And I would just encourage not just filmmakers, but also stunt performers to go through the whole process of making films. You can do it with anything now. I mean, everybody's got a HD camera in their pocket. This is crazy to think about. If I were to go back 15 years and tell myself this, I was like, get out of here. You don't know. That's impossible. What's HD? I wouldn't even know what the hell you're talking about, you know?
Yeah.
But now you can just do that. And
HD, 4K, man. 4K in my pocket.
Yeah, not mine. I got one of these phones, but
that's all right. The iPhone 13. I won't reach back because I fall off the chair and we're not vaudeville today. But that is a 4K camera.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, they even have LiDAR cameras on them now, so you can even you can shoot 3D. You can actually map out a whole scene. Yeah. So make short films. As a performer, you should make short films so that you understand how performance affects camera and how camera affects performance. Understand camera as a performer. Do camera work also. Be a camera op. The more you do this stuff, the more you can conceptualize
and edit your own stuff.
Absolutely.
Which is so easy now. I mean, it's all there, and we do anyway. Where do you think action goes from now? I mean, you can do anything. You can make people fly. You can do all the superhero stuff. You can do face replacement on stuntmen. It's so refreshing, though, for me to see something like John Wick, where they use a lot of visual effects and all the rest of it and the tricks of the trade, but you get to see the real deal also.
Yeah.
A lot of real fight in camera fighting.
Yeah.
But it's few and far between these days because you can just put people's faces on stuntmen.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, if I knew the answer to that, I could probably retire. There's always gonna be a desire to go back to what's real, right? It's like you still have theater, you still have painting. The stuff is still doing just fine. So I think that'll always be around. What I look forward to is when storytellers who don't have any money, who are in their basement, in their mom's basement, in a small town somewhere in the middle of nowhere, can open up Unreal and make a sci-fi film on a space station look as good as anything that Hollywood puts out.
That's the future, isn't it?
That's what I would love to see. And it's kind of happening. It's slow, but I'll say this, that as a filmmaker, if you're looking for work right now and you're having a hard time finding work, if you learn Unreal, study Unreal, the sequencer, and make a film in Unreal for 2 or 3 months, put a reel together, you will be hired. There just aren't enough Unreal people to service the market. Like, they're always, any Unreal artist that's out there just gets snatched up. And we know because we try and hire them at our company and they're gone. They're just gone. As soon as they pop up, they're gone. And film schools aren't, they're still not teaching Unreal at a lot of film schools. They still don't even know about it a lot of the time. But if you were to learn Unreal or Unity or Blender, guaranteed, you will not be able to stop working.
Good words. Well, Eric, it's been a pleasure, mate. I have been watching you for many years and always appreciate what you've done. Keep doing it, mate. I want to see some more original content coming out, like Rope-A-Dope and Blindsided. I was really blown away by those two in particular. And keep doing what you're doing, mate. And thanks for teaching us the art of action.
Well, thanks, Scott. I mean, it's all, for me, it's the same with you. You know, I was watching you in Hong Kong films back then too. And that was, you know, you and like Brad Allen and these guys, you know, so sad he passed, but being able to see, how you guys took that language and made it work in America, huge inspiration for all of us. So thank you.
Thanks a lot, buddy. All right then, mate.
All right.